TD1's maximum sustained winds remain below tropical storm strength at 35 miles per hour. Its center about 260 miles southeast of Nantucket, Massachusetts. As it moves to the east-northeast, it is expected to dissipate and have no impacts on land. For NPR News, I'm Phil Latzman in Miami.
The U.S. economy shrank again for the second quarter in the first quarter of this year, but the Commerce Department's updated figures also show that that contraction, which was at a 5.7% annual rate, was not quite as strong as what had first been expected. There was a modest rebound in consumer spending and in corporate financial performance, and that gave some analysts hope that a move out of recession could happen later this year. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Radio Maria Restaurant in downtown Champaign. Radio Maria's is now featuring their spring menu, along with tapas, served every evening until 2 a.m. Lunch is served on Friday and Saturday, 10:30 to 2:30, and brunch on Sunday. Information on their menus, wine, and beer lists can be found at RadioMariaRestaurant.com.
On June 11th, we hope to encourage 250 listeners to invest in WILL.
Your dollars will help AM580 build a better picture of what's going on in the world and how it will affect you.
Call with a pledge June 11th, our one-day Thursday fund drive.
Or give online now at willpledge.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be talking about affordable housing. That is, the thing we're talking about is the lack of affordable housing. It's certainly a serious problem all across the country. And what we'll be trying to do is maybe get some perspective on that, but also talk very specifically about efforts here to build affordable housing in Champaign-Urbana. And we have two guests with us. Len Heumann is Emeritus Professor of Urban and Regional Planning and Psychology at the University of Illinois. He does research on housing policy, particularly as it affects minorities and the elderly, and he has studied advanced housing programs for the elderly a lot of places around the world, including Great Britain, West Germany, the Netherlands, Denmark, Sweden, Israel, and Australia. His particular interest is looking at how people do things in other countries and how that might be applied to us here in the United States. Also joining us is Aaron Smith. He's executive director of the Homestead Corporation of Champaign-Urbana and has had that job since April of 2008. He's been in Champaign-Urbana for a number of years, a graduate of the University of Illinois. He's worked many years in the not-for-profit field locally, focusing on community organizing and social justice with different community and student groups, including the University YMCA and also the Illinois Disciples Foundation. And we're glad to have both of them here in the studio with us. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you both very much for being here.
Good to be here.
And we appreciate it. One thing I thought I would like to do, well, maybe first, the very first thing, I'd like to have Aaron talk a little bit about the Homestead Corporation of Champaign-Urbana and what it's all about.
Okay. Well, the Homestead Corporation is a not-for-profit organization, and our mission is to provide affordable housing to anyone with inadequate resources. The Homestead Corporation was formed in 1993, mostly to look at community needs for affordable housing. And in 1996, we received our not-for-profit status. And that year, we also became what's known as a community housing development organization. It's a special distinction that was created by the National Affordable Housing Act of 1990. Mm-hmm. And basically, it's a distinction that's given to not-for-profit housing developers to give them both technical assistance and also access to grant funds from Housing and Urban Development for development of affordable housing.
And right at the moment, I think it's true that yours is the only organization of this type in Champaign-Urbana at the moment?
Actually, there's one other.
That's right. Yeah. There is one other.
There's one other. There's another CHOTO in town, Ecolab, which does it's called it's Ecological Construction Laboratory. Mm-hmm. And they do super energy efficient housing using passive solar and a number of other green techniques. It's very advanced and very specialized, and they've done two houses, two single family homes to date. They just sold their second one on Fairview in Urbana. They have got some really wonderful plans for other housing developments they want to work on in the near future.
Okay. One of the things that I wanted to do as a way of starting out, and maybe Professor Heumann, you can talk about this, is just to talk a little bit about, on the national level, the problem of lack of affordable housing. And you know, one of the things I came across was a very sort of stunning kind of statistic. This comes from the Department of Housing and Urban Development, that a family with one full-time worker earning the minimum wage can't afford local fair market rent for a two-bedroom apartment anywhere
right.
in the United States.
Correct.
That's a pretty dramatic sort of a statistic.
And there's states like Illinois which are even higher than the national average. So, I mean, yeah, this is a major problem. And we're not talking necessarily owner occupancy here. We're just talking decent, affordable housing. And that's why there's so many people in homeless shelters. I mean, and families in homeless shelters, not just single individuals. And that's why we're in existence. The other reason to introduce me, by the way, is I'm on the board and I'm currently vice president of Homestead.
Ah, great. Maybe here another question, a basic sort of question is: you use this term affordable. Well, how does one define that? What's considered to be affordable housing?
Paying more than 25% of your income on housing. In other words, of your total expenses, 25% or more of it's going for housing, and they've actually upped it to 30% during the Bush administration. But
yeah.
A way to
so
cut
that,
the
that
statistics
is if it's
back.
if you're spending less than 30%, that's considered to be about where you should be.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we are talking about maybe we can talk about all levels here, because there certainly have been efforts to try to provide for kind of housing that people can actually buy. So you could have owner occupied housing, but is the main focus here rental?
We do both.
Yeah, we've done a mix of different types of projects over the years. Our first major development is Homestead Corporation. It's called Homestead Apartments. It's a property that we still manage, and actually my offices are located in the building. It's a 25-unit, what's referred to as an SRO, single resident occupancy. Mm-hmm. So it's 25 efficiency units for single adults. And all of our residents are formerly homeless individuals. You have to earn what's referred to as below 50% AMI. AMI is area median income, and that's a figure that's, for a specific region, and it's adjusted for the size of families. So all of our residents have to be below 50% AMI, and they have to be either homeless or in immediate danger of being homeless in order to get a unit in our SRO development. And that was one of our first developments, and that came out of our community involvement, looking at what was identified as specific needs in the community.
Yeah. And I seem to recall that there was quite a bit of controversy about this project when it was initially proposed. I think the people were really, particularly people who were living around where this place was going to be built, had some concerns about, what would that mean? Has this now come to be generally accepted by the neighborhood and the people who live around it?
We've really settled into the neighborhood.
I think we've raised property values rather than the other direction. We even had one of the people that were on the neighborhood committee against us become a board member, no longer a board member, but for a long time. And it's not like these are isolated. They speak with each other in the neighborhood as people come and go from Homestead Apartments. And it looks very nice. It fits into the neighborhood very well. It isn't a super large building, and you can expect people to have those kinds of fears going in. And we looked at so many sites to find someplace, and the NIMBYism, not in my backyard, approach was really hard and heavy, and we couldn't. The way the SRO funding came from Washington, we had to use existing buildings and couldn't build new, and we couldn't find anything. We actually ended up moving. You may recall, we moved, I think it was a officer's barracks from Rantoul, from the former Chinook Air Base, cut it in two pieces, removed the the asbestos and so on, and carried it down here in the middle of winter, put it back together, and so we had an existing building in Urbana. It was a real huge task to get that building up and going, but it's been a tremendous success.
Yeah. I think people here in Champaign-Urbana will recall not very long ago there was a story here where we had a place that had actually been a hotel. I think it had been a Holiday Inn. It was in – or maybe it was another – and it was in Champaign. And it was something that was being operated as rental property now. And something happened. The people who are running it allegedly were a little behind in there paying their utility bills. And the power company said, well – we're going to shut the power off, and with very, very short notice. And suddenly here there were people and there were families who were living in this place who suddenly find themselves really up against it, having to find some place to live. And that, I think, really pointed out a number of things, but it certainly pointed out the need for that kind of housing. Yeah. What is the – I'm sure that the demand must far outstrip the availability of places like that.
Oh, certainly, yeah. I mean, that was a very controversial, you know, event because the owners of that hotel were sort of operating in a gray area where they were still considered a hotel or a motel, but they were really leasing out their rooms on a long-term basis. And, there was quite a lot of controversy over how short of a notice a lot of the tenants got, and it was really unfortunate that things played out that way. But yeah, there is definitely a shortage of housing and much more demand for it than we have locally.
We probably should. You originally asked the question about owner occupancy, and we said, yeah, we did do that. And then we talked about at the SRO.
Sure.
Why don't you go across the whole board of stuff that we've...
Well, in addition to the SRO, we've done a number of other things over the years. We did single-family rental homes where we would purchase existing homes in the area that were dilapidated or run down, and we'd rehab them, and then we'd rent them out to large families. And we've also done single-family owner-occupied housing where we build new housing for low-income families, and they
first-time home buyers,
and they purchase from us.
Yeah. So, where does the money come from to do this?
Well, that's one of the distinct advantages of being having our designation as a CHODO, Community Housing Development Organization. We have access to what are known as home funds. Home is a program that's administered by Housing and Urban Development. There's a certain amount of money set aside by HUD every year for these programs, and it's administered through cities, municipalities, local governments, the state. Each one gets a certain amount of funding every year. Locally, it's what's referred to as the Home Consortium, and that includes the City of Urbana, City of Champaign, and Champaign County. But the funds are actually administered through the City of Urbana through their community development arm. And every year there's a certain amount of those funds set aside specifically for developments done by CHODOs, and we apply for those funds every year, and that becomes a large chunk of the funding that goes into our developments.
We might, from the philosophical side, mention a little bit more about what HUD had in mind when they developed the CHODO. It's a type of not-for-profit development that's unique in that what a third of the board needs to be.
Yeah,
low-income people who either live in the neighborhoods where the worst housing is, or on boards of social service agencies that also help service those people.
Yeah, in addition to the benefits of being a CHODO, there are a number of requirements that have to be met to get that designation, and it can be quite an endeavor for a not-for-profit to meet all those requirements. You have to have a board that's composed of one-third of its members of being members of the low-income community. So either people who are themselves low-income or live in low-income neighborhoods or serve as representatives of low-income neighborhood associations and of similar organizations. Also, your board can have no more than a third representation of people from the public sector. And the main reason for that is to keep public sector from having control over these development organizations. So you don't have people in city or state government running the how your organization is doing its development. In addition to that, there's a number of other requirements. You have to have at least a year of experience working either in low-income housing or development or in some way servicing the needs of the community that you want to work in as a developer. And there's a number of other things I could go into, too. But
sure. Yeah. Well, let me very quickly introduce again the guest, Aaron Smith. He is the executive director of the Homestead Corporation of Champaign-Urbana. It's a nonprofit that's dedicated to providing affordable housing. They've been around since 1993, and he's been the director since April of 2008. Also here in the studio with us is Len Heumann. He's emeritus professor of urban and regional planning here at the U of I. He's very interested in housing policy, particularly in the way that it affects minorities and the elderly, and he's also on the board of the Homestead Corporation. We're talking a little bit about the issue of affordable housing in Champaign-Urbana and particularly the Homestead Corporation and what they have done over time to try to provide housing. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just, again, a kind of a general question, and maybe this is Maybe the two parts here can't be taken apart, but is the affordable housing problem, is it mostly about people not having the income levels to have housing, or is it that there's a certain kind of housing stock that we really need that we just don't have?
Well, I think it's probably a combination of both, but the housing stock is definitely a major issue. Just there's just not, especially in rental, there's really just not that many properties out there that are affordable to people who are below a certain income level. You know, we're trying to look for solutions to those problems in the community.
You can see how demand grows in certain need areas, and since I'm a gerontologist as well as an urban planner, I've often dealt with the housing needs of the frail elderly. And next year, the baby boomers reach age 65, and we really start hitting a 25-year period where there's going to be tremendous needs and physical housing needs for that population. I think – I don't have the facts, so you're going to have to tell me if I'm right or wrong – when you look at the population of the SRO, of Homestead Apartments, when we started, it was primarily young men coming out of the homeless shelters. Mm-hmm. And one of our great achievements was these were people who had never held full-time jobs. They, you know, they had a lot of personal problems. And I think 20 of the 25 within the first 2 years had full-time jobs and were starting to even move out into conventional apartments. Now I think our waiting lists, I think the population is aged in place, the ones that have remained in the facility. And our waiting list is more among older people. A lot of families have been caring for an elderly person moving from family member to one to another, and they just can't, you know, they're having trouble getting by just raising their children, and they're looking for other places, and Homestead Apartments is one of them. So mm-hmm. there's a shift. And we, at our board meeting last October, we saw a gigantic increase in the waiting list to get into Homestead Apartments. So, I mean, there's tremendous evidence that we need at least another SRO somewhere in the community. Yeah.
Well, let's go back. How many units?
It's 25 units.
25 units. And what kind of a wait list do you have?
Currently, the waiting list has about 30 people on it.
About 3 a year?
Yeah. Like Len mentioned, our population in that building has aged in place, and we have a lot of people who are disabled, who are, you know, on permanent disability. You know, they don't really have much of an income, and so Homestead Apartments was designed to be permanent housing. Like, we want to provide the support for people to be able to transition out if they want to, if that's what they want to seek. But it's housing that's meant to be there for them as long as they need it. Mm-hmm. And as the needs of the people who've come into it have changed, we have people staying a lot longer. We still have people move sort of come in for a while and then move on to something else. But our vacancy rate has gone down dramatically the last few years. Last year, we only had 3 units open up the entire year. Yeah. So far this year, we haven't had a single unit open up. And our waiting list is growing all the time.
And I don't think to this point, I've asked what the rent is. What's it cost to live there?
The rent, we operate as what's known as a project-based Section 8. So we have a certain set rent, which is below market for a unit of that type in this area. But the rent that the tenants actually pay is based on their individual income.
Oh, okay.
Like Len mentioned, they can't pay more than 30% of their income as rent. But in actuality, we have a lot of tenants who have virtually no income or very little income, and they pay a minimal rent, which is $40 a month. The actual rent for the units is currently $413 a month, but very little of that is actually paid by the tenants. The rest is picked up by the by Section 8 payments through the local housing authority.
Mm-hmm. And just to make sure that I'm clear and everybody's clear, Section 8, this is the kind of program where there are a couple of ways that the government subsidizes housing. They can subsidize it by giving the money to the people who own the property, essentially, mm-hmm. or they can subsidize it by giving the money to the renters, mm-hmm. and then it sort of goes through them to wherever
yeah.
they go.
Yeah, the way we are set up is we're project-based, so the Section 8 subsidy comes with the development itself. So the tenants don't have to get vouchers on their own and then come to us with them. They move in and that subsidy is already there for them, but it doesn't – that subsidy doesn't go with them when they leave. It stays with the units.
Okay.
So the units themselves are subsidized.
We have a caller here, somebody in calling from Chicago, so let's talk with them on our line 4, the toll-free line. Right here. Hello.
Thank you. As of today, I just heard of a new contest to build a solar independent dwelling, 800 square feet, as this was announced on TV a short hour ago, to build 800 square feet dwelling for those who can find that to be sufficient. But along the lines of energy, are you taking into consideration for your construction, energy that would be supplied other than the traditional gas and coal or whatever.
Perfect timing.
And heat pumps and so forth, as well as thinking in terms of other than traditional construction methods, modular homes that could be stacked on top of each other, rather than building on site. So there's different ways that have been proposed. I remember after the Second World War, where much of Europe was bombed out, and the concern was about how to build the structures again. They just were going along and taking modules and stacking them on top of already pre-existing dwellings. So there's so many new innovations. I just thought I'd offer them in consideration. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, and one of the reasons that we're doing the show is that we really want to tell people, particularly people in Champaign-Urbana, about a new project that you're working on. I think they just had the groundbreaking last
May 20th.
Last week, yeah. And in which you're trying to – some of these kind of ideas that the caller raises, you're building into the project.
Yeah, I'm glad we raised this. We're involved with a development known as Crystal View Townhomes. It's a redevelopment of a former public housing site known as Lakeside Terrace in Urbana. It's right next to Crystal Lake Park on Broadway Avenue. And it was a public housing site that was built in the 1950s. And it was in 2004, the Housing Authority, which was managing it, decided that along with HUD, that there was no way that they could continue to maintain it in a way that was acceptable, to a standard that was acceptable for people to live in, and the decision was made to demolish that site and redevelopment. Crystal View Townhomes is the redevelopment of that site. We're partnered with a for-profit developer out of Chicago, Brinshore Development. It's not that uncommon for these types of developments to have a for-profit company partner with a not-for-profit organization to carry this out. We're co-developers on the project. And in addition to providing much-needed affordable housing and redeveloping the area, it's going to be a very green development, incorporating a lot of different energy efficiency techniques. It'll be all geothermal heating and cooling. Some of the buildings will have solar panels to provide to subsidize some of the energy costs. All the buildings will be super insulated, very tight construction. A lot of green materials used, a lot of recycled materials, especially on the exteriors, a lot of green space. We're employing a lot of techniques to deal with stormwater runoff, bioswales, and a lot of imaginative landscaping techniques to sort of deal with the stormwater and things like that. I mean, we're really excited about the development. It's going to be, as far as affordable housing developments go, it's going to be very unique in terms of the green aspect of it. And we work closely with the city of Urbana in sort of putting this development together. And that was a major concern for the city, is that we incorporate as much of these green techniques into the development as we could.
Yeah. And does that add to your upfront construction costs?
Yes.
Does it make it more expensive?
It does. It does. I mean, it's a 70 unit development. So when it's all done, we'll have 70 new units of affordable housing on the market for families. It ranges from 2 to 3 and 4 bedroom units, and it's a mix of incomes, from very low income units to moderately income units. But it does add to the upfront cost for us. We have approximately a $16.4 million budget for the development, and there's a lot of different sources in that. One major source in that development is a grant that we received from the State Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity for energy efficiency. So they have fairly high standards that we have to meet to satisfy those grant requirements. Yeah.
You know, one of the things, and I expect maybe Professor Heumann, we've talked about this. I have this feeling that in other conversations about the issue of affordable housing, we've talked about this, and that is this question of, is the reason that we don't have the housing stock we need that for-profit builders and people who are going to operate in the for-profit world, apartment complexes, they would say there's no money in this for us, and that's why it is that that nonprofits and government has to be so heavily involved, because the for-profit sector says we can't afford to do this.
Yes and no. This project that we're building with a for-profit developer, and it's a tax credit project coming out of Washington. That is, the profits can be shared by investors in the project, who can then get a tax credit that can shelter other income that they have. And this has been a real push throughout the last two administrations to bring the private sector into building affordable housing. Now, that said, this project would have never happened without CHOTO being involved in it, and the kinds of grants and loans and mortgage guarantees that CHOTO can get, as far as on their own without any kind of subsidies, it's virtually impossible for someone who wants to make a profit and who's taking tremendous risk up front in buying land and developing that land, and so most developers are very careful. They avoid as much risk as possible, and they aim towards the center of the market where the greatest demand is, especially those that are building larger developments in the suburbs. And they feel they can't provide any housing for low-income people. And then, like in the SRO case, many of the people who are living there can't deal with a conventional landlord either. They have very special needs. They have very unique amounts of energy they can put into keeping up their housing, even the interior of it. And it really takes a hands-on management system. And our management system has involved Family Services of Champaign County, has involved Parkland College, has involved a number of social service agencies, the Mental Health Center. There's a social worker on site how many hours a week?
About 20 hours a week.
Yeah. I mean, so this is not something a for-profit landlord is going to get involved in. So there is a portion of the market where not-for-profits like us just have to fill the gaps.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a very for a for-profit entity, it's a very risky area to get into because there's so much more to deal with. I mean, if you're a for-profit developer who just wants to make some money, you can always just throw up something substandard that people can live in. And, you know, it'll last a few years and then it'll kind of become dilapidated and they'll walk away with whatever they make. But so when you're looking to these partnerships, you really have to find a for-profit developer who's really interested in providing good, affordable housing. And I think we're really lucky in that we managed to form this relationship with Brinshore because they've done a number of affordable housing developments over, I think, 5 different states. They have a couple here. They were involved with the redevelopment of Birch Village on Bradley Avenue in Champaign. It's now called Douglas Square. Mm-hmm. That's a really wonderful development. I've been out to a few times. And they really have a lot of experience and a lot of skill at dealing with the affordable housing market. And it was really an ideal relationship because as a large for-profit developer, they bring equity that, you know, a small nonprofit organization just doesn't have. You know, they bring development resources that it's hard for us to get. But we bring in the community aspect that, you know, we have a relationship with the cities, with the government, with the local community, and we can bring in access to funding that they can't get themselves.
Like Brinshore, over the years we've been involved with other for-profit and not-for-profit developers who have their heart in the right place and really want to provide a unique and high-quality service here. Very seldom do not-for-profit housing corporations start with an SRO. That is such a difficult thing to start with. Mm-hmm. But we had a group called Lakefront SRO up in Chicago who had been not only doing this, but they were taking old buildings that were quite historic in and close to the lakefront and creating wonderful new housing that helped turn around old blocks and neighborhoods. And we got training from them. They came down here and talked to us. We went up there and talked to them, you know, on how to plan this whole thing out. And there really is a whole community that's been evolving over the last 20, 30 years throughout the United States of these not-for-profits and how they help each other out and now also getting for-profit developers who can partner with us. And it's a growing area. It's still tiny compared to conventional housing that gets built each year, but it's growing.
Mm-hmm. We're a bit past the midpoint here. Let me just introduce again our guests, Aaron Smith. He's executive director of the Homestead Corporation of Champaign-Urbana. They've been around since 1993. It's nonprofit. They're interested in providing affordable housing. And also Len Heumann, he's on the board. Did you say that you were the vice president?
Yes. Right.
Vice president of the board of Homestead Corporation. He's emeritus professor of urban and regional planning and psychology at University of Illinois. And in his research, he's particularly interested in housing policy as it affects minorities and the elderly. And questions welcome here. We've been talking about the problem of affordable housing, that is, lack of affordable housing, and very specifically Champaign-Urbana, our area, what the Homestead Corporation is involved in. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number if you'd like to call in. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, you can give us a call. Back a little bit earlier, I asked was this the only organization of its kind? And you said no. Actually, there was one other, but it's much smaller. They have a very specific interest in building green housing, and they built a couple of them. So here now in Champaign-Urbana, we only have two, and one much smaller than Homestead. Is there something particularly difficult with particular challenges that come with actually trying to set up something like this?
Oh, I mean, definitely. I mean, you really the CHOTO designation is not something you can just sort of like put an application in for and then get it. It's something that's awarded by the local home program administrator. So you basically have to convince the local here. It's be the Urbana Home Consortium. You have to convince them that you can be a successful developer is basically what it comes down to, in addition to meeting all these other requirements. There have actually been other CHOTOs over the years. The Urban League, which unfortunately closed last year, they had a development arm which had a Chota designation. And it was really unfortunate to see them go because they were one of the most successful affordable housing developers in the area. And they had a number of other really important programs for low-income families. So it was not necessarily a shock when the news came out because, you know, there'd been some talk about sort of the financial difficulties they were having. But it was still, you know, really unfortunate and sad to hear that they had closed. So basically it means that there's more work for us to do because we have to sort of pick up the slack of having one less Chota in the Champaign County.
I want to tell another little story here because it may sound like, you know, there's a lot of money out there for us and everything's kind of set up and all we have to do is do it. And I want to go back to our scattered site housing program. At one point, we looked at the statistics for Champaign-Urbana, and we saw the greatest need was for larger families, families that needed three or four bedrooms and beyond. And we wanted to provide that housing by using existing housing that had become dilapidated and fix it up, take the worst house on the block, fix it up, and make it, you know, a really attractive addition to the quality of that block. And we wanted to scatter these throughout the community so that there's no major impact in any one area. Now, this sounds like, you know, a really good deal. Mm-hmm. Last year, we sold off our last five of those units because it was bankrupting us. And a couple of things were happening. Some examples that things still have to evolve and others that we pass laws that we better be careful in helping people provide affordable housing. Otherwise, we take it right off the market. One of the things that occurred was the laws for lead paint abatement became much more strict, which they should, especially for large families with a lot of children. But in this market area, there was no expert remover of this. We had to go far afield. We couldn't dispose of the lead paint in this community, and it became extremely costly. And basically stopped us from rehabbing. Also, the local governments, when we had these scattered site apartments, saw us as private landlords, and we wanted to collect property taxes on these buildings, which basically swamped the income that these people brought with them in with a Section 8 voucher. So, and the third thing was our own idealism. When you have all this scattered site units and you have to manage them and these people have unique problems within their neighborhood, you have to visit them quite often and keep tabs on them. And that becomes extremely expensive when gas is starting to go over $4 and so on. So in effect, we were losing money and we had to sell them off to a private landlord. Yeah. So we can't do everything, and some of the hardest things are still impossible to do.
Let's talk with another caller here, someone here in Champaign County, where we are. Line one. Hello.
Hi. I don't want to gainsay the mortgage interest tax credit program too much, since I am actually using it as a residential person. Both Champaign and Urbana were implementing it. I don't think either of them are doing it anymore, but... And you know, it's great to hear that you're actually using it to develop that Lakeside Terrace. I'm struck by the fact that there had been a rule that was, I guess, abandoned during the Clinton government that you had to replace every low-cost housing unit. You couldn't just develop them and not replace them. And that went by the boards, and I wonder whether you have gross statistics on how the, you know, lower income market availability of housing has been affected by that, since so much has been taken down. But it seems to me that, you know, dealing the bondholders in is like, you know, you're paying them off to get the program through. Basically, the bankers are in favor of it. But you know, what about just a real housing program, a jobs program that builds houses? I mean, obviously the developers are going to say it's going to undercut the market, but it's a little specious now since the market is so undercut already. And it seems to me that it's the other point I wanted to make and let you comment on, and I'll hang up and listen. I'm sure I'm jamming too much in here as usual. It's so ironic that we have people talking about the housing glut, and that's why the market has collapsed. And at the same time, we know there's a shortage of housing. It's just that McMansions were built, and nothing was built in the affordable and mixed use sort of vein. So I'll hang up and listen.
Yeah, okay.
I have
okay.
Well, questions, but I'll hold them now. Thanks,
Aaron. Do you remember how many public housing units there were in Crystal Lake, and how many are left now in Crystal View?
Well, in Lakeside Terrace originally there were 99 units. I mean, it was a very dense site. I don't know if you remember it specifically, but it was sort of almost sort of a barrack style development. It was constructed in the 50s when there was sort of a different attitude about what sort of affordable housing should be developed. And the current development is going to be 70 units, and it is a reduction. It's not going to be a one-for-one replacement, you know, a brick-and-mortar replacement for every unit that was out there. But, I mean, part of that decision came from the fact that trying to maintain that sort of density of low-income families was just not sustainable. And we're hoping with this development that we're going to provide something that's a lot more that's sustainable and a lot better for the residents.
And of the 70, there's a handful of them that are market rate, right? That have no subsidies.
They're referred to as market rate, but the rents are actually set so that they would be affordable for someone who's below 80% of the area median income. It's a mix of different units. Trying to remember the exact number. Sorry, there's 7 units out of the 70 that have rents that are set at for people who are earning below 30% of the area median income. That's referred to as very, very low income. In addition to that, we also have 18 units that will be operating as a project-based Section 8, something I referred to earlier, that will be administered through the Housing Authority locally. And the rents for those units will range over different income categories. But in effect, what happens, because most of the people on the Section 8 waiting list are very, very low income, even though the set rents vary, the rents they'll actually be paying are going to be, you know, they're going to be adjusted for their income, and the rest is going to be picked up by Section 8 subsidy. So in actuality, a total of 25 units are really going to be for people who are very, very low income. And then the rents for the other units are set to like about 50% AMI and 60% AMI. And then we have a small number of units that are referred to as market rate, but actually the actual rents are set so they could be affordable for someone who's earning.
And are the units all the same? Or if you pay more, you're going to get more?
There's no difference in the units based on the rents. The rent distribution sort of ranges over all types of units. So we have 3 and 4 bedroom units that are set with 30% AMI. It's mostly 2 bedrooms, the large majority, but there's quite a few 3 and 4 bedroom units. And a small number of those, maybe 1 or 2, would have what's referred to as market rent, but the rest would be distributed over the other income categories.
Let me say a little bit about the larger issue that the caller brought up, and that is, yes, we have not replaced one-for-one brick-and-mortar the public housing we've been tearing down and the new projects we put up, mainly because we don't want to create new low-income ghettos. We want to have a more diversified population living in each of these places, and as a result, it takes a lot longer to find new sites to build new projects. What we did do, and almost from the get-go, I think the federal government realized they weren't going to be building them one for one, is they upped the number of Section 8 rent vouchers. So they gave more of these people in the housing that was being torn down a rent voucher to go look for new housing. Now, that being said, several of my students started studying where those vouchers were used. And what happened with a lot of low-income people is they tended to stay much more in low-income neighborhoods. They just couldn't drive out to the suburbs and look for a subsidized housing, or an apartment with that voucher in hand, even if they had a car, and they don't. They have maybe multiple jobs that they have to keep up in a large family. And so most of them end up renting very close to where that public housing was. And that's also somewhat of a disadvantage for us as a society and getting all incomes more integrated. But again, I think I hope the new administration will start looking at that issue and realize we have to do some more building. Yeah. So the caller was right, but everybody's quite aware of it.
Well, it gets to a point where – and we're coming maybe about – we have about 5-6 minutes left. Something that I want to make sure that we talked about and taking into consideration what you have tried to do with building in some diversity, at least some diversity of economic level in – among the people who will be living in this development. And it strikes me that we segregate in housing on along all kinds of levels and in kinds of ways, and racially and ethnic there's segregation, there's economic segregation, there's segregation in terms of single people, married people, families. We segregate really in a lot of ways. We segregate according to age. And that raises this issue. Well, what if we're trying in a deliberate sort of a way to have a diverse population? If we could, if we'd had what we really would like, if we're going to build a new development, you'd like to have some mix of single people, families, younger people, older people, a diverse sort of economic to have a real mix, which is difficult unless you deliberately set out to do that. So the question is, well, why do you think that matters? Why would you say that would be a desirable thing to have that kind of mix of people? What do you get if you do that?
Well, in some ways you get a stronger sense of community. What would you really get is role models for people, but you also get job opportunities. I think people are surprised at it's who you know, not what you know, so often for getting a good job. And living in a neighborhood where a neighbor knows of job openings in your skill area makes a big difference than being in a neighborhood where everybody is unemployed or marginally employed and getting better role models in education. There's just so many ways that we benefit from a more integrated community. And we really then do give equality of opportunity, at least as kids are growing up and as adults are looking for work. I'll just leave it at that because I can go.
that sort of diversity of clients is something that's really built into how we've structured our development. In addition to the sort of income distribution and the different sort of communities that we're going to serve, there's also a number of units that are set aside to be fully accessible for handicapped individuals. There's a number of units that are set aside for people who require supportive housing services, so people who are in the community who need some sort of supportive housing, whether it be social, mental health, various other needs, there are units that are specifically set aside for those individuals as well.
I'll put one thing in with regard to the elderly, and because we have going to hit a major aging block starting next year, with the economy the way it is, a lot of extended family can't take care of their elderly members, and they don't live near them anymore. The whole corporate state and the way we find and get moved around in jobs, we don't live close by as extended families. And neighbors are going to have to, you know, be the surrogate family for a lot of these people. If we segregate the elderly from the rest of society, that built-in support and the kind of support that keeps them active and caring for themselves at the margin of their ability, which is going to lower the price of moving into much more unaffordable and costly institutional kinds of care facilities, is going to be part of our lives in the coming years. It's a type of green solution, is one that we take advantage of the skills and the abilities of us as our communities and the people that live in them, and we don't have to rely so much on government, which can't provide as humane and as caring and as affordable sets of help to people. So, I mean, there's just so many ways it makes sense to have a diversity of people within a neighborhood. And we've made a lot of mistakes as urban planners. The whole zoning thing tends to artificially put housing here and then only a certain kind of housing here, more dense housing here, less dense there, and makes it too easy in a way for conventional developers to constantly push further out into suburbs and spread the cost of all of our support units, be it police, fire, social service agencies, having to cover wider and wider areas. So we're looking to get more flexible zoning and more flexible code enforcement and other types of things that aren't so rigid and so categorical that they just drive up the prices of everything.
Yeah. We're almost at the point where we have to finish. We have been talking a lot about the efforts that you've been involved in to develop rental housing. And I think that you said at the beginning of the program that that you had been involved in some of the other kind of thing, too, where you were trying to develop property that could be purchased.
Yes.
And I suppose some people now would question whether we pushed home ownership too much in this country and whether part of the economic difficulties we're in now are related to that. Maybe setting that aside, do you think that how important do you think that is? And I expect that probably also presents special challenges, that trying to develop a kind of housing stock that would be affordable for people to buy.
Yeah. I mean that's definitely an issue that we have to sort of look at in the light of what's happened in the last couple of years. Yeah. But I'm proud to say that we've developed and sold 11 single-family homes in Urbana and Champaign over the last 5 years. And of all the homes that we've completed and sold, you know, they're still occupied by the people who purchased them. They're still affordable for those individuals. We haven't had any foreclosures. And a lot of that is based on how we approach our development. We work closely with local lenders who really care about providing home ownership for low-income families who are not getting, you know, families into these sort of exotic instruments. Like, we're getting them into very conventional mortgages that have, you know, fair terms and which they can afford. Yeah. And that's been our model for how we've developed. And it's worked out well for us. Unfortunately, the way things have gone has presented a lot of challenges for us in terms of getting people into mortgages, just because it's so much harder to get money from lenders.
Well, I'm sorry to say we're at the point where we just have to finish. Just one more question real quickly. Again, I realize we're jumping around, but just before we leave it, Crystal View townhouses, when do you think that they'll be ready for people to move in?
I believe the first units will be available for rent up between August and October of this year. And
so that's it?
We have a 12-month construction window, so we're expecting to be completely
and
done.
And the waiting list is filling up.
Yeah, so we already have people calling it. If I can give out a number.
Yeah,
if people are interested in getting leasing information about Crystal View Townhomes, the number you can call is 328-0132.
All right. And if you have...
We want people who want to get on the board, too.
We might want to. Well, as I pointed out, we do have to have a certain representation of the low-income community on our board. We've had a number of great individuals over the years who we've worked with who have come on to our board. We have a couple of our board members who are actually homeowners who purchased homes from us in the past and are now on our board. But it's sort of a struggle for CHOTOs to get that low-income representation on their board. So we're always looking for people who are in the community who want to get involved.
Right. And for people who have internet access, you just want to find out more about the Homestead Corporation of Champaign-Urbana?
It's homesteadcorp.org.
All right. Our guest, Aaron Smith, he's the executive director of the Homestead Corporation of Champaign-Urbana. Len Heumann sits on the board. He's also emeritus professor of urban and regional planning and psychology here at the University of Illinois. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Focus 580, our show, supported in part by Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Now with four area locations, including inside the new Activities and Recreation Center north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus. More information is at bodyworkassociates.com. We will break at this point, as we usually do. We'll be back with more Focus 580. First, though, an update on the markets and news. Please stay tuned.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, Hudsonville, Illinois, and Crescent City, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
With this market update at a minute before 11 o'clock, I'm Tom Rogers. Sinking dollar is encouraging investors to buy commodities, and the commodity markets are showing quite a big increase. July wheat right now up 11.5 cents in Kansas City at 642 a bushel. September up 12 at 668 and three quarters. July corn is up 3.75 cents. At almost four, you know, 3.75 cents at 432.5. September corn at 442.5, up 3.5 cents. Dece corn up 4 at 456.25. I made a mistake and gave you the Chicago numbers instead of the Kansas City wheat. So the Kansas City is up 12 to 12.25 cents. The crude oil contract right now is also up $1.14 a barrel at $66.22. Arbob gasoline at $192.4. That's up 1.4. In the soybean pit, July nearby beans up 2.75 cents at 11.81¾. August at 11.44, up 3.5, and soybeans for September at 10.92.